I am a PhD student here at Southern Evangelical Seminary. I have a Master's of Arts in Christian Apologetics, and I teach, actually from Jacksonville, Florida. I teach ethics, introductory survey into the New Testament. I help a little bit with the Old Testament class, but because I'm not credentialed yet, my main areas of interest are archaeology and philosophy and worldview, which is interesting because very rarely do they ever overlap. Except for with the documentary hypothesis, which is what I'm going to be speaking about today. I'm going to be reading for you guys a paper that I have recently written, which I hope will be the framework for my later dissertation with my doctorate program. And it's basically oriented towards answering the question of the documentary hypothesis has been refuted and rebutted so many times it's not even funny. Why is it not gone? And so I'm going to propose how I think we need to go about getting rid of the documentary hypothesis. So let's just go ahead and dive in. Julius Wellhausen's documentary hypothesis has been the standard view of ancient Israelite history and biblical studies since shortly after its introduction in 1899. This theory divides the Pentateuch into three documents and reconstructs ancient Israelite history in a way that makes it the creation of the monarchical through post-exilic periods of Israelite history. This reconstruction presents a serious problem for biblical reliability because it makes Israelite religion, as recorded in the Pentateuch, the creation of progressive periods of religious and political propaganda. It makes Israelite religion at various stages dependent upon the socio-political culture of the period in which the given document was constructed. If this view is correct, there are serious implications not only the theological statements contained within the Pentateuch, but also the theological claims made in the remainder of the Old Testament, as well as the New. For example, if the narrative about the fall of Adam is not historically accurate, then 1 Corinthians 15:21 and 22 is called into question, which has serious implications for the doctrine of salvation. If the narrative about Abraham is not historically accurate, then the covenant between God and the Israelite patriarch did not take place, which means that the Jews were not the legitimate owners of Canaan, nor did they play any significant role in the lineage of the Messiah. Not only does the denial of the historical reliability of the Abrahamic narrative have implications for the remainder of Old Testament history, it also presents issues for the Christian understanding that grace is through faith rather than works, as portrayed by Romans 4. Additionally, if the Exodus and law narratives are not historically accurate, then the calls of repentance and return to the law, as proclaimed by the prophets, are illegitimate, and the reason behind the exile is lost. Despite many attempts by evangelical scholars to respond to the issues raised by Wellhausen, Wellhausen's theory remains the predominant view of ancient Israelite history, so much so that even evangelical Christians such as Kenton Sparks have begun to incorporate it into their interpretive methods. Given the significance of the implications on Christian theology that arise out of the conclusions of the documentary hypothesis, it will be useful to understand why the theory has survived in order to better understand how to combat it. The purpose of this paper is to show that the only way to combat the documentary hypothesis is to recognize it as a paradigm in the style of Thomas Kuhn's scientific paradigms, which uses constructivist methods in the style of Bosiever and Frossen's constructive empiricism, and to focus our scholarship on creating a more convincing alternative paradigm to replace it. This will be accomplished by a brief introduction of paradigms, followed by an explanation of how the documentary hypothesis fits the standard of a paradigm, before concluding with a discussion of how evangelical scholarship should proceed in order to disentangle biblical studies from the documentary hypothesis. So, paradigms. In philosophy of science, a paradigm is a structured and directed way in which a scientific community goes about solving puzzles. It contains general theoretical assumptions and laws and techniques for their application. A paradigm sets the standard of legitimate work within the science it governs, while coordinating and directing the puzzle-solving activities of the group of normal scientists who work within it. Normal scientists are those who work within the paradigm in order to find matches between the paradigm and nature. They presuppose that the paradigm is capable of solving any puzzle posed within it, and are uncritical of the paradigm. They must be uncritical of the paradigm in which they work because it is only by doing so that they are able to concentrate their efforts on the detailed articulation of the paradigm and to perform the esoteric work necessary to probe nature in depth. When a puzzle is unable to be solved within the confines of a paradigm, it is primarily seen as a failure on the part of the scientist, rather than as an inadequacy of the paradigm. If a puzzle resists solution by a variety of scientists, it is viewed as an anomaly rather than as a falsification of the paradigm. It is only when a significant number of anomalies become apparent that a paradigm is considered to be in a crisis state, at which point it is only replaced when a new paradigm emerges and attracts the allegiance of more and more scientists. According to Alexander Bird in his article, Kuhn, Nominalism and Empiricism, Kuhn's paradigms are an anti-realist view of science similar to Baas van Frossen's constructive empiricism. Baas C. van Frossen claims that science aims to give us theories which are empirically adequate. An acceptance of a theory involves as belief only that it is empirically adequate. In his PhD dissertation, J. Thomas Bridges summarizes van Frossen's constructive empiricism in the following way. 1. One need not believe a theory is true in order to accept it. 2. One accepts a theory based upon its empirical adequacy, that is, the theory is model isomorphic with the appearance. And 3. The scientist's adoption of a theory for the purpose of styling phenomenon can contribute in a mind-independent way to the causal relationships he establishes between the objects. Given the above information about constructive empiricism and paradigms, the key feature in relation to the current discussion is that the way to combat constructive empiricism is not through falsification, as the standard of acceptance is adequacy, not truth. This means that an anti-realist theory is not rejected because of anomalies, or because there are things for which the theory cannot account. These are viewed as irrelevant and outside the explanatory scope of the theory. Because the paradigm is seen as essential to the work of everyday science, it is not rejected unless a more adequate theory is presented and wins approval within the discipline. So is the documentary hypothesis a constructivist paradigm? Given the description of constructive empiricism and paradigms, there are a few reasons to conclude that the biblical criticism's view of ancient Israelite history is an anti-realist constructivist paradigm. The first reason is that adherence to the documentary hypothesis only accept answers from within the framework. Kenton Sparks' book, God's Words and Human Words, provides an example that illuminates this element in categorizing the types of responses to biblical criticism. Sparks breaks the responses into traditional and constructive responses. Those which are in the traditional category are responses which reject the conclusions of biblical criticism, while those that are considered constructive are those which recognize the validity of the conclusions of historical criticism. He is only willing to consider answers that fall within the framework of Israelite history as posed by biblical criticism. All answers or responses that question the framework are harshly criticized based upon a standard that even Sparks is not able to live up to in his own work. Another area in which the documentary hypothesis' view of Israelite history shows evidence of being a paradigm is in the responses to critics of critical conclusions. As described in the previous section, normal scientists within a paradigm do not question the paradigm. They assume the truth of the paradigm, and failure to provide an answer from within the paradigm is seen as the failure of the scientist. Sparks portrays this in his complaint against traditional responses when he claims that they do not present the critical evidence in the coherent way that critical scholars present it. Sparks is only able to view the Pentateuch through the lens of critical conclusions. When he is presented with traditional responses that critique critical conclusions, he does not question his framework. Rather, he views the presentation of the responder as the problem. Traditional critiques of Pentateuchal criticism present the evidence from within a different framework, a framework with different theoretical assumptions and techniques. As a result, their conclusions are not valid to Sparks, because it is only by working with the evidence from within the critical paradigm that one's research has meaning. Another way in which the documentary hypothesis fits within the definition of a paradigm or construct is that issues which may conflict with the framework do not falsify the framework. One of the primary assertions of the documentary hypothesis is that there is a progressive view of God seen through the documents of the Pentateuch. In the Jehovah's document, Yahweh is human-like. He is found walking with through the garden after creation, wrestling with Jacob, and making himself visible to Abraham before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. However, with the maturation of the Israelite cultus, a maturation of the view of God takes place until God is viewed as abstract and transcendent in the purely monotheistic versions of the Pentateuch described in the priestly code. Yet the issues with this claim is that there are theophanies in the exilic and post-exilic prophets, which is precisely the time in which the documentary hypothesis claims God has been abstracted away from the anthropomorphic view attributed to ancient Israelite history. Daniel 3 contains a theophany in the narrative about the fiery furnace, and Ezekiel 1:26 portrays God having a figure like that of a man while sitting upon a throne. The post-exilic book of Zechariah claims the Lord has roused himself from his holy dwelling and will live among the people in chapter 1, verses 10 through 13, which is the same kind of anthropomorphic language found in the Jehovah's document. Additionally, the entire New Testament portrays Jesus as a man and deity. All of this conflicts with the documentary hypothesis portrait of the maturation of Israelite history. However, the theory is not considered falsified, given these obvious contradictions. Rather, these issues are considered anomalies and ignored by those that work within the paradigm. So what is our approach? J. Thomas Bridges, in discussing Ramhar's view of philosophy as science, shows the path to replacing a paradigm when he says, and this is a long block quote, "One of the important roles for the philosophy of science is to make explicit what assumptions go into a particular view of the world, and that by making these assumptions explicit, we can accomplish at least two things. First, we can change these assumptions for alternative assumptions that will give us the different view of the data. This can be done, Haar says, systematically, explicitly, and controllably. Second, by making these assumptions explicit, one is no longer bound by them in the same way that the man who adopts them unconsciously is. It was said above that scientists usually unconsciously adopt the paradigm within which they are working. It is the role of philosophy of science to make them aware of these assumptions so that given an alternative, they can make an informed decision. By giving scientists and the scientifically minded an alternative theoretical framework, they can begin to see the data set in a new orientation based on a different set of underlying assumptions. This is the right strategy for bringing the crisis in neo-Darwinian theory to the point of revolution," end quote. If the documentary hypothesis is an anti-realist constructivist paradigm, which based upon the previous section it appears to be, then attempting to discredit it through falsification of its underlying points, while helpful in exposing its inadequacies, will not cease its utilization by contemporary biblical studies. In order to bring the documentary hypothesis to the point of revolution, traditionalist scholars must not only respond to critical arguments and make critical assumptions known, but they must also propose an alternative theoretical framework. Richard Elliott Freeman, in Who Wrote the Bible, claims that Wellhausen's documentary hypothesis is unique because of its powerful construction, because it did more than just divide the sources by the usual criteria. It tied the source documents to history. It provided a believable framework in which they could be developed. If the power behind Wellhausen's theory is in its artful construction of a believable framework, then the best approach to combat it is to provide an equally, if not more, believable framework that ties the text of the Pentateuch to history. This should be done by identifying the assumptions behind the documentary hypothesis. Many of these assumptions are shared with general biblical criticism, but there are a significant number of additional assumptions held by Wellhausen as a result of his dependence upon E.B. Tyler's evolutionary theory of religion. As we pointed out in the previous quote from Bridget, it is only by making these assumptions explicit that one is no longer bound by them in the same way that the man who has adopted them unconsciously is. By unbinding contemporary biblical scholars from unconsciously accepting the assumptions of the documentary hypothesis, it becomes possible to systematically, explicitly, and controllably change these assumptions for alternative assumptions that will give us a different view of the data. So we're going to take a slight detour into a section of another paper, and I can make some of Wellhausen's assumptions that overlap with Tyler explicit. In creating his evolutionary theory of religion, Tyler makes some assumptions that guide his research. These assumptions lead him to see religious types as being interdependent and progressive. One type leads to another as the cultural and political structure of a people group changes. In other words, as the culture becomes more civilized and more intellectual, changes can be viewed in terms of their religious structure. Tyler's primary assumption is the truth of the Darwinian evolutionary theory of progression. The theory of evolutionary progression is built upon the idea that the simple leads to the complex. It is a worldview in which the second law of thermodynamics is reversed, claiming that order increases with time rather than decreases. In such a system, that which is more simple is older than that which is more complex. It is a worldview in which mankind, the most intellectually complex of all current living species, is the result of a successive mutation of previously less complex versions of our current species. As Robert Bella argues in his more modern version of Tyler's theory, mankind as we know it today is the result of increasing biological capacities that create first language, then increasing intellectual abilities that ultimately allow for abstract thought and theoretical contemplation with each progressive evolutionary stage. It is only within the context of a worldview in which the simple is the more ancient and the complex the more recent that a successive view of religion can be formulated. Tyler's argument that all religious types can be strung together on the string of animistic belief in the soul and that what is responsible for their differences is different intellectual and socio-political stages is an admission of his assumption of Darwinian evolutionary progression. Part of what allows Tyler to accept an evolutionary view of human progression is the cultural snobbery that views his particular cultural structure as superior to all other existent forms. He views the scientific advancement of Western culture as being the pinnacle of human civilization and all previous forms as savage and barbaric. In a section on whether cultural progression is singularly directed or whether relapses into savagery are possible, Tyler quotes Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which portrays Tyler's view of the quality of different cultures. This is a long block quote. The discoveries of ancient and modern navigators and the domestic history or tradition of the most enlightened nations represent the human savage naked, both in mind and body, and destitute of laws, of art, of ideas, and almost of language. From this abject condition, perhaps the primitive and universal state of man, he has gradually arisen to command the animals, to fertilize the earth, to traverse the oceans and measure the heavens. His progress in the improvement and exercise of his mental and corporeal faculties has been irregular and various, infinitely slow in the beginning and increasing by degrees with redoubled velocity. Ages of laborious ascent have been followed by a moment of rapid decline, and the several climates of the globe have felt the vicissitude of light and darkness. Yet the experience of 4,000 years should enlarge our hope and diminish our apprehension. We cannot determine to what heights the human species may aspire in their advance towards perfection, but it may safely be presumed that no people, unless the face of nature is changed, will relapse into their original barbarism. This is essentially Tyler's view of the quality of various cultures. While he does not necessarily advance Gibbon's view of an exclusively progressive view of history, as Tyler allows for periods of decline, decay, and recession into rudeness, the point of this quote is that he views culture in terms of better and worse, perfect and imperfect, based upon their ingenuity. His culture is the highest state of civilization, and all other cultures are graded comparatively upon their degree of modernization. Tyler's entire view of culture presupposes one standard of measure. It assumes that one culture is superior to all others and measures every other instance in terms of how it measures up to the preferred model. He gives prominence and superiority to the area he finds preferable and makes that the standard for all other points of history. All of history is viewed and measured in light of his preferred period. What also becomes clear from the above quote is an evolutionary view of intellectual capacities. Tyler makes the assumption that certain kinds of thought are too primitive for certain stages of culture. Gibbon speaks of the savage man being naked in mind and progressively improving his mental faculties. This assumption is further exposed by Tyler's argument that monotheism is an abstraction from henotheism and too intellectually advanced for primitive tribal cultures. Tyler concludes that monotheism was the invention of thoughtful men who were engaged in speculative philosophy. These are people who have moved beyond the simplicity of viewing life in terms of cause and effect into an intellectual realm that allowed them to do theological speculation. Another of Tyler's assumptions is that primitive cultures are unconcerned with ethics. He sees the assumptions of ethics with, or the association of ethics with religion as being a result of the organization of culture. It is semi-civilized and civilized cultures whose religions are instilled with ethical meaning and directives. While the savage cultures have directives that regulate interaction between individuals, the commingling of these with religious ideas with a divinely inspired set of directives was something that came out only of the organization of culture and therefore should not be in primitive cultures. Tyler's final assumption is that the religious types are able to be directly linked to a socio-political organization of a culture. Once the souls of animism are deified, there is a direct correlation between the view that people have of their deities and how they view their political leader. In the most primitive of societies, when social organization was still family-oriented, the original deities were the actual spirits of the departed family members. As in means worship, as social organization became more stratified due to the incorporating of more than biologically related individuals, the deities are no longer family members, but more like superhumans. Because the social makeup is still small enough that the individuals do not feel a complete separation from the political leader, their deities are still relatable and human-like, even if not in the same way as deified ancestors. As tribal societies become kingdoms and the political leaders become more remote from the average man, so too are the deities of these societies. The political leaders of kingdoms are still ethnically related, and thus to some degree relatable, so the people do not feel completely detached. In the same way, the deities of these societies reflect in the change in the felt distance from the political leaders and become more abstract, though they are still human-like in the way they interact and relate to one another. As societies become more hierarchical, the organization of the religious ideas and deities also become more hierarchical until the point when the political leader is seen as completely disconnected from the average man. Once this detachment between commoner and political leader is achieved in the cultural environment, the deity of the society becomes abstract, transcendent, and distant in nature from humanity. This view that religious types are directly correlated to the socio-political climate of a given people group assumes that religion is created with society as the blueprint. It assumes culture as the precondition of religious ideas and essentially invalidates religion in general. If one is to believe that religious ideas are reflections of the culture, then no religion has the ability to be true or false. They are merely expressions of a political experience of people projected in a spiritual sense. Such a view naturally assumes atheism and a lack of authentic deity. One example that we're only going to go over one example where Wellhausen overlaps with Tyler, just for time. And that has to do with history in light of a preferred period. Tyler's influence on Wellhausen is evident in Wellhausen's acceptance of Tyler's primary assumption. The first of these assumptions is that a particular area of history is superior to all other areas. For Tyler, all cultures are graded and arranged on a progressive scale based upon their degree of modernization. Because Tyler's area of preference in his own time is his own time. Wellhausen, on the other hand, has a preference for a period of the kings and the prophets, which is extremely influential in how he views the rest of Israelite history, literature, and religion. In the introduction to the Prolegomena, Wellhausen recounts the beginning of the journey that led him to create the documentary hypothesis. And in doing so, he says, and this is a longer quote, "In my early student days, I was attracted by the stories of Saul and David, Ahab and Elijah. The discourse of Amos and Isaiah laid strong hold on me, and I read myself well into the prophets and historical books of the Old Testament. Thanks to such aids as were accessible to me, I even considered that I understood them tolerably, but at the same time was troubled with a bad conscience, as if I were beginning with the roof instead of the foundation, for I had no thorough acquaintance with the law, of which I was accustomed to be told that it was the base and postulate of the whole literature. At last, I took courage and made my way through Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and even Noble's commentary to these books. But it was in vain that I looked for the light in which was to be shed from their sources on the historical and prophetical books. On the contrary, my enjoyment of the latter was marred by the law. It did not bring them nearer me, but intruded itself uneasily, like a ghost that makes a noisy deed but is not visible and really affects nothing. In continuing the pursuit, I only fell into deeper confusion until I learned through ritual that Carl Henrik Graf placed the law later than the prophets, and almost without knowing his reasons for the hypothesis, I was prepared to accept it. End quote. The significance of Wellhausen's transparency is that it illuminates why he reconstructed Israelite history in the way that will be shown later. Wellhausen's primary area of biblical interest was in the period of the kings and the prophets. Upon diving into the world of a patriarch, Wellhausen's view of his preferred area became marred. And upon finding an explanation that restored prominence to his preferred area, he claims he was willing to accept it without knowing the reason. This displays Wellhausen's preference for a particular period of history. Wellhausen claims that before studying the Pentateuch, he felt as though he was beginning with the roof instead of the foundation. However, what he ends up doing is reconstructing Israelite history so that the period of the kings and the prophets are no longer the roof. Rather, he makes them the foundation. He admits his bias from the beginning of the project without realizing that his very bias draws his conclusion. One such example of his reorientation has to do with the tabernacle in the temple. If one gives no preference to any period of Israelite history, the biblical narrative claims that after the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt, God gave the Israelites instructions regarding worship. They were to build a tabernacle, which would contain the Ark of the Covenant, and all Israelite worship was to take place at the tabernacle until such a time as the permanent dwelling would be created. This permanent dwelling would later be constructed based upon the formula of the tabernacle and would become what is known as the temple. However, Wellhausen's claim claims the exact opposite is actually what took place. In Wellhausen's version of events, the tabernacle is the copy, not the prototype, of the Temple of Jerusalem. He finds this to be evidenced by the fact that the description of the tabernacle is repeatedly made of its south, north, and west sides, without any preceding rubric as to a definite and constantly uniform orientation. The interesting thing about this objection is that the description gives the orientation he claims is lacking. If one approaches the description of the specifications of the tabernacle in Exodus 26 and 27 without a bias against the period, the indications of north, south, east, and west provide the proper orientation. One could easily presume, without damage to the text, that the tabernacle was to be set up with the same orientation each time it was moved. North, south, east, and west are the only permanent orientations for a nomadic people group and are heavily utilized by ancient cultures in their sacred site construction. According to David Fidler in his article, Luminous Alignments, sacred site orientation based upon luminous alignments is a common occurrence in ancient cultures. The arrangement of sacred places in reference to the rising sun is seen in Egyptian temples, Stonehenge, a 5,000-year-old mound at New Grange in Ireland, Greek temples, Native American medicine wheels, and Central American pyramids. The tabernacle specifications orient the opening of the tabernacle as being on the east end, toward the sunrise, which seems to indicate that the entrance should always be facing towards the east. It should be oriented towards the sunrise. Thus, the orientation Wellhausen claims is lacking if one does not come to the text with a preference for orienting Israelite history around the kings and prophets exists. Wellhausen also makes his preference for the period of the kings and prophets evident in what he considers historical in a narrative. In discussing the patriarchal narrative, he says the materials here are not mythical, but national, and therefore more transparent, and in a certain sense more historical. It is true, we attain to no historical knowledge of the patriarchs, but only to the time in which the stories about them arose in Israelite history. This later age is here unconsciously projected, says Wellhausen. In one sentence, Wellhausen claims the narratives are not mythical and that they contain a historical sense. And in the very next sentence, he claims they have no historical knowledge about the very subject matter they are addressing. The only historical knowledge these texts are capable of providing to Wellhausen is about the period in which he thinks they arose, the period of the kings. His rationale for dating them to the period of the kings and prophets is that the patriarchal narrative there is a parallel between the patriarchal relationship and the socio-political environment of the land of Canaan during the period of the kings. 1 Samuel 14, 2 Samuel 8, 1 Kings 11, and 1 Chronicles 18 discuss conflicts between the kings of Israel and the Edomites. At various times, Saul, David, and Solomon fought battles against the Edomites that included the enslavement and ultimately the slaughtering of almost all of the Edomites. According to Genesis 36, 9, Esau was the forefather of the Edomites, while Jacob was the forefather of Israel. In Genesis 27, Jacob tricks Isaac into giving him Esau's blessing, which is that Jacob will be lord over his brother, and that his brother will bow down to him. When Esau asks for some residual blessing in chapter 27, verses 39 and 40, Isaac adds that Esau will live by the sword and serve his brother until such a time when he will break the yoke of the servitude from his neck. In discussing the blessings which Jacob receives and the warning Isaac gives Esau, Wellhausen sees the text as being a reflection of the monarchical political circumstances backwards. Wellhausen states the stories about Jacob and Esau cannot have taken form even in outline before the time of David. He goes on to claim that the Jehovah's author was so blatant in his projection that he does not even attempt to conceal the correlation. The realism Wellhausen sees the story of Jacob and Esau as a blatant projection is in his distrust of genealogies. In addressing this, he says, and this is a block quote, all these nearly related and once closely allied Hebrew tribes are shown in the patriarchal narrative to be intimately connected with the inhabitants of the Mesopotamian desert and sharply marked off from the Canaanites in whose land they dwelt. The narrative speaks of its characters as succeeding each other in time or contemporary. In this form, it indicates a logical or statistical subordination and coordination. True genealogies can scarcely represent precisely the existing relations. It cannot always be determined, as a matter of fact, whether a tribe is the cousin or the brother or the twin brother of another tribe, or whether there is any affinity at all between the two. The affinity can be understood and interpreted in different ways. The grouping always depends, to some extent, on the view of the genealogist, or even on his likings and antipathies. In other words, the patriarchal narrative cannot portray patriarchal history because it traces genealogies from the patriarchs to the groups that are involved in the socio-political frustrations of the periods of the kings, and true genealogies are impossible. He believes true genealogies are impossible because one cannot always determine beyond any doubt whether a tribe is related to another tribe. But not always does not equal never. These would be logical subalternates, and some does not account for all. While discussing the limitations of biblical criticism in his argument, The Legitimate Limit of Biblical Criticism, Merrill Tenney addresses a similar objection made about the chronologies of the kings of Israel. He says, for years, the chronologies of the kings of Israel and Judah defied reconciliation, and many scholars had concluded either that the biblical text was corrupted or that it was historically untrustworthy. However, E.R. Thiel ended up showing that there was a legitimate explanation for a lack of clarity because he operated under the assumption of the essential truthfulness of the text. Tenney uses this as an example of one of the limits of biblical criticism, which is the lack of positive contribution. He says, and it's a long quote too, to enumerate apparent inconsistencies or disagreements in its text may be a part of the total procedure of investigation, but to conclude on a basis of insufficient evidence that these indicate unreliability is quite another thing. The aim of a healthy criticism should be to seek a fuller understanding and confirmation of the purpose of sincere writers and to clarify their obscurities, rather than to make these obscurities a reason for rejecting their testimony. These limitations do not circumscribe the scholar in his investigative work. He has the utmost liberty to search for evidence, to classify and interpret it, to view the Bible in its light, and to formulate hypotheses of interpretation that may prove helpful. However, they do mean that he cannot honestly entertain a hostile bias to the scriptures and at the same time do them justice, nor can he treat any hypothesis as fact when it has no sufficient material evidence to support it. He should be sure of his premise before he asserts emphatically the finality of his conclusion. End quote. This quote from Tenney beautifully depicts the many issues with Wellhausen's claim that the patriarchal genealogies are indicators of kingdom period authorship. To claim that the genealogies of the patriarchs are not true, because true genealogies are not always possible, is to presuppose the conclusion. He does not prove that the genealogies are false, or that their dating to the time of the patriarchs is false. He merely asserts that they cannot possibly be true. In this case, rather than finding inconsistencies, Wellhausen is claiming lack of truth due to too much consistency. He is claiming there is too much consistency between the genealogies and the actual tribal relationship in the kingdom period, and there is insufficient evidence that these were not created in the period of the kings, so they were created during the period of the kings. He comes to the text with a bias against any period prior to the period of the kings, and therefore treats his hypothesis as fact. He does not approach the text while assuming a sincerity in the writer. He approaches it with a belief that the revisionist history for political maneuvering. Therefore, he finds precisely what he aims to find. If no historical period is given preference, then the conflict between the Israelite monarchs and the Edomites would appear to be the fulfillment of the prophetic words of Isaac. Given the previous examples, it's clear that Wellhausen approaches Israelite history with a preference for the period of the kings and prophets. Because of his preference for these periods, he reorients the biblical narrative to bring prominence to these periods. He views the history for this period as supreme and reorients all other periods in such a way as to maintain the prominence of this period. This is an overlap with Tyler's assumptions that one period should be used as a standard measured for all others. There's five other assumptions that we're not going to go through because that was like a 70-page paper. So back to our argument. We've seen that there is an overlap between Tyler and we've exposed some of the assumptions, and that was our first step. In addition to making the assumptions explicit, traditional scholars should identify the areas of scripture where the documentary hypothesis appears to be more convincing than the traditional historical view. Rather than focusing on what claims within the documentary hypothesis are false, efforts should be made to identify the areas in which the traditional historical view's explanations are not considered to have superior adequacy over the documentary hypothesis. As discussed earlier, constructivist paradigms trade in terms... Sorry, my paper's upside down. Trade in terms of empirical adequacy, not in terms of realist truth value. As a result, attempting to falsify a paradigm's claims will not result in the overthrow of the paradigm. Only by identifying the areas in which the documentary hypothesis appears to provide more adequate explanations can traditional scholars begin to formulate an alternative theoretical framework that provides critical scholars with another way of viewing the data. The third step is to identify anomalous data and areas of irrelevance within the documentary hypothesis. This entails identifying the areas in which the documentary hypothesis is not capable of providing an adequate explanation. These are the areas which have been utilized in most of the attempts at falsifying the documentary hypothesis. For the most part, this is where contemporary critical anti-criticism responses have focused their efforts. The final step is to incorporate the findings of the previous three steps into a coherent framework that has superior empirical adequacy over the documentary hypothesis by 1, making the assumptions of the documentary hypothesis explicit, 2, identifying the areas where it provides a more adequate explanation than the traditional historical view. 3, identifying the areas where it is incapable of or uninterested in providing explanations, i.e. anomalous or irrelevant areas. Traditional scholars will be in a good position to formulate a framework that has superior adequacy over the documentary hypothesis by including these 3 steps. While it may seem as though the traditional historical view of scripture is already a framework utilized by conservative scholars, this framework is one born out of historical assumption and must be formalized in such a way as to be competitive with the documentary hypothesis. Wellhausen took the variety of Pentateuchal critical scholarship and painted a picture of Israelite history that draws the reader into his world. He did not utilize much space in arguing against alternative theories or to present advanced document scholarship. Rather, he created a succinct, offensive argument for his view of ancient Israelite history. Much of contemporary traditional scholarship is a response to the claims of the documentary hypothesis. It is a defensive strategy. Contemporary scholars who wish to combat the documentary hypothesis must stop going on the defensive and switch to an offensive approach. By utilizing the findings of the first 3 steps, contemporary traditional scholars can switch from defense to offense by focusing on creating a succinct picture of Israelite history that draws their readers into their world. Gary Habermas, in arguing for the historical reliability of the resurrection of Jesus, does this in his minimal facts approach, which argues for the validity of the resurrection based upon only those facts accepted by critical scholars. He claims that his decision to only utilize evidence that critical scholars accept as historically valid was a methodological move in order to bypass protracted preliminary discussions. Habermas's argument, while often referred to as a defense of the resurrection, utilizes offensive strategy. Habermas shows evidence of having studied critical scholarship on the subject and then makes a strategic, succinct argument that best utilizes the findings of that study. This is the direction in which arguments against the documentary hypothesis must move. Rather than focusing on arguing against the documentary hypothesis, which is unfalsifiable, and contemporary scholarship must argue in favor of something else, namely, a new theoretical framework that exposes the underlying assumptions behind the currently accepted framework, while also dealing with both the issues that the current framework neglects and those it handles well. By constructing a new framework in this fashion, traditional scholars will be able to argue for the superior adequacy of their framework by showing that it is the best explanation because it has superior explanatory scope, explanatory power, and plausibility, while also being less ad hoc and more illuminating. Arguments to the best explanation is one of the 2 methods utilized by contemporary historians to determine the historicity of an event, as explained by Mike Latkona in The Resurrection of Jesus, A New Historiographical Approach. The other method is to argue from statistical inference, which takes statistical probability into account. If contemporary traditional scholars can provide a framework that satisfies both of these methods for historicity, then the chance the new framework will be considered more adequate than the documentary hypothesis is strong. In conclusion, the best way to beat an opponent is to study not only their weaknesses, but also their strengths, in order to create an effective strategy to combat them. Football coaches and teams spend hours watching game recordings of their competitors so that they can tailor their own strengths in a way that will take advantage of the weaknesses of their opponents in order to increase the chance of their own victory. However, the first step in ensuring their victory is to know the rules of the game. It will not do an American football team any good if they attempt to play by the rules of soccer or hockey. They must play by the rules of American football in order to achieve success. In the same way, contemporary traditional scholars must know the rules of the game and play by them if they hope to bring about a revolution in contemporary biblical studies. They must recognize that they are interacting with anti-realist constructivist theories that deal in terms of adequacy rather than realist truth value, for it is only by doing so that they can hope for any measure of success. Attempts at falsifying the documentary hypothesis will not result in it being discarded. Rather, the surest means of success is through exposing its underlying assumptions while presenting an alternative theoretical framework through which scholars can view the data. The path for replacing the documentary hypothesis has been paved by the creators of the documentary hypothesis, where they successfully overthrew the previous framework. It is now time to utilize the methods they used to bring about a revolution in biblical studies in order to bring about a new revolution that will restore the historical integrity of the Pentateuch and safeguard the scriptures from the theological implications of the documentary hypothesis. Thank you. Question? Yeah, in the back. Yeah. Sorry. Let me flip back. Thank you. Oh, I have them outlined here. Thanks. All right. So, history in light of a preferred period. That one I gave you the example of. Religious expression is tied to culture. So, that would be the progression from animism to monotheism. Tyler makes the argument that as their kings become more distant, their religion parallels. Wellhausen does the same kind of thing. He doesn't go all the way back to animism, but he does start. He goes with the anthropomorphism, so they're kind of like humans, and as they get further along and fall under imperialism with, you know, Persia and the Babylonians and all of them, God becomes more abstracted away. So he just has like a subset of Tyler's greater religious evolution. Evolutionary progression. So that's the idea that the simple moves to the complex. Morality is a late development. He also makes the argument that all the moral precepts, the law part of the Pentateuch, is the latest discovery. He doesn't think that there's any requirement for, there's no such thing as idolatry to Wellhausen prior to the law coming in the post-exilic period. So he thinks morality is the result of this abstraction into monotheism. And then certain things are too intellectually advanced for early cultures. He makes the same argument that the more advanced part of the law is too intellectually sophisticated for a tribal people group. So only during the intellectual advancement of the exilic and post-exilic period that they could have come up with something that advanced. And then the last one is just atheism in general. Because if you can reconstruct all history, whether it be, or all religion, whether it be any religion, or if you can reconstruct all Israelite history, you can reorient them in the way that they're both reorienting them. You have to assume that religion's not true. That's what you get if you say that the Judaism progresses through this intellectual advancement, then all the actual claims it makes can't actually be true.
So what's the status of acceptance of the documentary hypothesis across the seminaries?
Everywhere. It's just reeking with it everywhere you look. I teach for Southeastern University, which is their Assembly of God. And then I also teach for Houston Baptist University online. And right now I'm actually teaching an Intro to the Bible course. And I just teach what they give me and the books that we're reading at an evangelical school, Bible-believing school, to talk about the Bible as a story and narrative. And it's all this language that escapes the historical reliability. And they're trying. I mean, the school doesn't want to throw historical reliability out the window, but it's kind of become assumed that you can't escape it. It's this, we've been stuck with Wellhausen, we can't refute it, it won't go away, and it's just, as a result, a couple of generations, 100 years later, is just immersed out into everything. And so, I mean, it's even being accepted by a lot of the Jewish cultures as well.
Well, it's been my experience that, I mean, certainly at large, the skeptic community takes it for granted that the Old Testament is not historical. Well, I've seen a lot of mainstream Christian apologists that, when engaging the skeptic community, you know, more or less, for the sake of argument, concede that the Old Testament is not historical, whether they actually believe that or not, just because their goal is to focus on the Christian, the resurrection, or the existence of God, and the Holy Spirit. Do you think there needs to be more effort amongst the Christian community to defend the history of the Old Testament? Is that?
I look at it this way. Either the Bible's true or it's not. And if that's the argument we always make. You can't pick and choose what's true. And so if we're going to defend the entire Gospels, entire New Testament is based upon the foundation of the Old Testament. I mean, what do we argue is one of the main arguments for the reliability of Jesus? He fulfilled X number of Old Testament prophecies that could not have been fakes. Well, if the Old Testament's not true, then he didn't fulfill any. So if we throw the Old Testament, the historical reliability of the Old Testament out, Genesis, or the Gospels make no sense. What Jesus did makes no sense. And so, yeah, maybe he rose from the dead, but what grounds do we have for believing that's history if we've already trashed the first half of the entire book? I mean, that's the way I look at it. I know that there's a lot of people, I mean, I was raised, my personal story, I was raised in church, Christian school, all that kind of stuff. Somehow along the way, I don't know how, I came to believe that evolution was true. And I was like, well, if I can't believe the history of the first two chapters of the first two books, why am I reading the rest of it? And I think that there's a lot of people out there who we say, well, we're just going to focus on Jesus. But there's a lot of people who say, well, if the first half of it's not true, then why would I even care about Jesus? And so, sorry, I think you've been waiting. So realism would be based on, actually corresponds to reality, and anti-realism would be saying that we're not actually tying it to anything tangible. We're okay with accepting this and saying that it doesn't actually have truth value, we're just using it as a framework. Does that make sense? Yeah.
So I'm actually in a conversation right now on Facebook with a couple of atheists about what you just said, that we have to accept the whole Bible. And so I gave a 6-point case, basically, from Greg Kokel about why I believe that the Bible is the Word of God. And now they're taking it a step further and saying, well, why is Hebrews in the Bible? So how do we know that, so if we just take it as this large chunk of literary work, what we know is written, so what if there's books that are supposed to be in the Old Testament that aren't? What if there's books that are in the Old Testament that shouldn't be in the Old Testament? So you can maybe say, that's a longer conversation.
That is the short answer that I would give is the Old Testament, we inherited that from the Jews. And so canonization of that is not up to us. And the Jews, there's a very rigorous process of how they preserved and canonized all of that. That can be studied. And then the New Testament, there's criteria for canonization there as well. And so I would say that there are plenty of books that may or may not be valuable in understanding the culture or what was going on at this period of time that we can use, like the apocryphal books. We as Protestants don't use them. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're invaluable. They're just not considered divinely inspired. And so that's the short answer. I think you were...
Yeah. What extent of the Old and New Testament is the documentary hypothesis applied to?
What extent is... Sorry, repeat that.
I mean, is it just the Pentateuch, or is it the entire...
So, it ends up stretching the entire Old Testament, but it's basically reorients the Pentateuch so that it's the creation progressively from the period of the kings through the post-exilic. So basically what he says is, depending on whose version you take, and Wellhausen kind of won because everybody jumped on his bandwagon, but there was a variety of different ways that people sliced up the Pentateuch into different source documents. They basically didn't take it like Genesis was one source, Exodus is another. They like pulled verses out of the string of the entire, and they said, well, based upon this name, we think that this is one author. And based upon this name for God, we think that this is another author. And so Wellhausen kind of proposed three. And he says the Yahweh, Jehovah's, and the Deuteronomists. However, there are others who claim more. And basically with that, he says that we can see a progression in Israelite religion based upon these documents. And we have a very anthropomorphic, primitive religion that moves into a little bit more stylized, with more formal worship. And then ultimately we get the very formalized version that we get with Deuteronomy and the law. And he sees that as mirroring as being the guide for how Israelite history is interpreted. So he would say, anything before the kings, as far as history is concerned, scrap it. It's just a personification back of the period of the kings and the prophets. And so then he would say, the kings are like the pinnacle, and we probably have good historical knowledge for that. And then the period of the prophets, he would reorient any of the prophetic messages that are a call back to the purity of Israelite religion, getting rid of polytheism and idolatry and all that stuff. He says, oh, that's all that's all a recreation that's pushed back after the purified version of Israel comes back from the exile. So the only people who actually came back from the exile were the religious zealots, and they were the ones who created this whole Levitical law and Deuteronomy that's so strict. And so he actually ends up, as a result, we lose almost the entire Old Testament history-wise because of the thread that he winds through it. I don't know who was first.
The idea, he was talking about the canonicity and everything. You have to establish a standard. You said that they arbitrarily picked their view of the standard,
yeah.
Much more breadth to better is. And you didn't mention that they had the law coming later as being better, and yet, as you just said, the entire end result of their argument is to throw out the law as unhistorical.
Right.
And irrelevant.
Right.
So, how can that be better? It kind of self-refutes itself. And they pick the standard, and if they're allowed to pick a standard, why are not we not allowed to pick a standard? And who is to say whose standard is better than the other?
I agree. Yes, they've just picked arbitrarily a standard. They're using the evolutionary model as their standard, and that is winning in the secular field, and it's bleeding into the evangelical field. And I think the church for a long time ignored it and said, well, we don't need to accept their standard, and we can have our own. But the reality is that even in the most evangelical of circles, they're not listening to traditional arguments anymore. So I think we have to beat them at their own game. I don't think we have to accept the evolutionary theory, but I think we need to be as whimsical as they are. Instead of being on the defense and saying they're wrong, and these are why, we need to be as wise as serpents and harmless as doves and beat people back. I don't know of any that are this strategic. This was literally, I wrote this for a paper a couple months ago. But that's going to be that's going to be my dissertation. So.
Bible students that can work.